And the court will proceed to the second case of the day, United States versus Van Sack. Mr. Ravitz.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gary Ravitz. It's my privilege today to have a few minutes to address you on behalf of Joseph Van Sack, whose constitutional rights were violated in this case when he was forced to wear shackles during a jury trial at which he represented himself. And I intend to devote essentially the entire portion of this argument to that issue, but I would be remiss, I think, at least in not touching another issue we've raised in this case, which has to do with the application of Crawford and the Sixth Amendment. In the government's brief at page 30, I think they correctly point out that is an issue of first impression in this circuit, and they ask this court to take into account the judgments of at least two other circuits, that being the Third Circuit and the Second Circuit. I think we've addressed the Second Circuit case in our reply brief. I won't touch upon it here. I note, however, the government has also cited the case of United States versus Tralla, T-R-A-L-A. As I think, however, the Supreme Court on January 9th vacated that judgment and remanded it for consideration, reconsideration by the Third Circuit. So I would suggest that that may not be the kind of authority this court ought to follow. Turning then to the issue of shackles, I think the Supreme Court teaches us that the Constitution prohibits the use of visible shackles.
Well, not prohibits.
Well, the Constitution.
It says that essentially what we said is that they're not to be, under normal circumstances, they're not permitted.
That's right. And
but there are abnormal circumstances.
Sure. And the cases, I think the mere condition suggests an extreme and unusual cases, it was last resort, extreme need. That's the kind of language one sees. And the cases in which physical restraints such as shackles or even something more extreme such as gag orders are involved. But I would agree that the general rule is that shackles ought not to be used. And the reason's obvious. They're inherently prejudicial to a defendant.
I don't think you're going to get an argument even with the government on that issue.
Therefore, Judge, I believe that the shackling order should be subjected to close judicial scrutiny. And
there
I respectfully submit that there's no adequate justification in this case for the shackling order Judge Castillo entered. Consequently, we're going to ask the court to afford Mr. Van Sack a new trial in this matter. As a threshold matter, I think one incident of the court's review has to involve whether or not Van Sack was fully and fairly informed that his conduct was wrong and warned of the possible consequences of continuing in his misbehavior, including the possibility he would be shackled. Now, the record shows...
Let me interrupt. Does the... in your opinion, did the incidents that give rise to the right to shackle have to occur in the immediate trial, or can it be based on the record of the prisoner itself?
It's an interesting issue.
That's why I asked the question.
There are some cases, Judge...
I'll try one more time. In your opinion, does the incident that leads to the right to shackle have to occur in the trial itself, or can it be predicated on some other behavior that has manifested itself in other areas or other trials?
I would agree that it could be manifested by other incidents. However, I think that one of the factors that has to be considered is whether, in the context of this case, there was evidence...
I'll back up again. Assuming that that answer that you've given, and I agree with it, that prior incidents can give rise to it, why is an admonition that if you don't behave yourself, we're going to shackle your hair, when they're not relying upon his ability to control his own behavior, but on his manifestation of inability to control his behavior?
In this case, let's say Judge Castillo refers to the disciplinary records from the MCC regarding Van Sack.
Yeah.
In, for example, passing upon Van Sack's motion to represent himself in this case, could have taken that opportunity at that time.
Yeah, but you see, here's where we're at. I'm not sure that a simple admonition is sufficient once you've established the fact that he's a potential dangerous person to have in a courtroom. I mean, the safety of the people in the courtroom should be paramount in a judge's mind, too. document in some place the constitutional right not to appear in shackles gives way to your prior behavior pattern. And I don't see how admonishing somebody during the course of the trial that we don't want you to hurt anybody or kill anybody is that's fairly obvious on its face, it seems to me.
I think it goes, though, to Vancetcha's opportunity to be heard, which I think was essentially not afforded him.
But the opportunity to be heard assumes something that is not... To be heard on what? That I didn't do those things? Or that they don't exist? Or do you have a new trial... You have a mini trial before the trial as to whether or not the disciplinary discussions are correct or incorrect?
That would be one option that would be available to a judge. In fact, in this
why
case,
couldn't
however,
it, why couldn't then, it, well, as a matter of sheer sensibility for purposes of judicial time and so on, he take that position that you have manifested in the past, this, and I'm going to keep you in shackles and go from there? It's not at all an unusual thing to do it. The problem, of course, is how you maintain when a pro se litigant the fact that the shackles aren't there, which you can generally do otherwise.
That is one of the features, I think, which suggests that Judge Castillo abused his discretion in this case. Because
so we have to find that his order to require the shackles is an abuse of discretion.
Sure, and it has to be tied to the exercise of Faretta right in this case. Now, keep in mind that the whole issue of self-representation percolated for months and months prior to the trial.
Sure did. But if I follow your idea correctly, once a prisoner has decided that he wants to represent himself, the shackles problem immediately is you can't have it.
Well, it's certainly something that had to have been broached by the court, I think. That's the kind of thing that Vincent should have been
admonished about.
Well, the
court was well aware he was going to represent himself.
Well, the court was aware that Vincent wished to represent himself as early as September 2004. Now, that motion by Mr. Vincent was raised again in October. Prior to February 8th, 2005, he filed numerous motions, and there were hearings both on the 9th of February and February 17th, immediately before the trial. Now, the court at no time advised Vancetcha that the trade-off, as it were, for representing himself might be that he would be required to wear shackles. Indeed, the only thing he was admonished about was that if he got out of line, the judge was going to pull him off the case and have me try it for him. So
That has nothing to do with safety. That has to do with the act goofy. We're going to let some
right,
somebody
exactly
else.
Right.
You don't have to. Not a safety issue at all.
Exactly right. And with respect to the first day of trial when the shackles appeared, of course, Mr. Vancetcha made immediate and timely objection, and the court at that time said it was acting in deference to the request of the U.S. Marshal Service. And I would suggest that's not an adequate justification. I think that while it's true the trial court certainly may rely heavily on the opinion of the Marshal Service, it can't delegate to the executive branch what is essentially a judicial determination.
The duty of the Marshal Service is to make sure that people in the courtroom are safe, including the judge. But also that extends to the jurors and the prosecutor and the defense, even you.
No question about it.
For which we are eternally grateful. So why shouldn't the judge defer to the the background and experience of the people who are sworn in to protect them as to what is necessary to advance that protection?
I think it's a question of separation of powers. I think the judge has to...
That's precisely my point. Separation of powers, the Marshal Service is to protect. The judge is not there to protect anybody except through his possible way through orders. Remember the great separation of powers was the judge has neither sword nor purse.
Yes.
And you're talking about a sword, and that's that aspect of it is the separation that I'm interested in.
I guess I would say that the judge can defer certainly to the executive in matters involving security of the jails, security of
the prisons. Why not security of the courtroom? That's very paramount.
I think that is a judicial function, not an executive function. And saying consequently...
Well, it is a judicial function, but the question is, can he take into account the opinion of the marshal? That's what he did.
No question
about
it.
There you go.
No question about it. But at the time he imposed a shackle order, the only justification was that he was acting in deference to the recommendation of the U.S. Marshal Service.
Did the district judge examine in any way, on the record at least, any lesser intrusive ways of perhaps handling the security problem?
No. And in
fact, there was no discussion of whether he should require the defendant to remain behind a podium or stay in one part of the courtroom. No talk about using a stun gun approach or anything of that nature?
No, Judge. And that is one of the reasons, again, I would suggest that Judge Castillo abused his discretion.
So your
here.
Point is he examined uncritically
yes.
the recommendation of the Marshal Service without exploring alternatives which might have reconciled the various considerations before him. Is that right?
Yes. We've taken issue with the government's suggestion on appeal that it was somehow Mr. Van Satch's responsibility to suggest alternatives lest he acquiesce in the shackling procedure. Well, we don't think that's the law here. We think this decision is a decision that is given to the judge, and certainly this court has suggested that it might be proper to consider the government as having the burden to justify a shackling order.
And of course, last term the Supreme Court told us we better start taking these issues a little bit more seriously.
Yes. We think that the government's request at the end of the first day of trial, after the jury had been selected and sent home, to ask the court to state additional reasons came too late and really didn't advance the question of justification, adequate justification for the shackling order. And in summary,
in what regard were those suggestions inadequate? What, Mr. Evans, would you suggest it be further advanced?
In terms of?
Well, you said the government at the end of the first day made its suggestion after the jury was selected.
They simply asked the judge to state additional reasons. They offered no reason, the prosecutors offered no reasons of their own to support the shackling order.
Yeah, and I suspect the government did that in part because it had the kind of concerns that Judge Ripple perhaps
yes.
has suggested ought to be considered. And what did the judge do in response to that?
The judge then referred to some specifics of Mr. Van Satch's records as given to him by apparently the Marshal Service. Now, those records, of course, have been sealed and they're part of the record in this case. And I'd like to turn to that. Let's talk about the justifications based on those records. Mm-hmm. I think the key issue here is that the jury was aware of these shackles, and the shackles were readily visible to them throughout this case. This is not a case, as you point out, where a defendant was ordered to remain at the table, where the table was papered over, where he was kept behind a podium. There's no question, because of the Feretta decision, to let him represent himself, and the jury invariably would know about the shackles. I'll give you an example. The geography of the courtroom lends itself to that, as do the government's practices with its witnesses. Judge Castillo's courtroom was set up in a way where you have the jury box, then the government table, and the witness stand closest to the jury box. When witnesses were brought down to use charts or exhibits and asked to describe those to the jury, Mr. Van Satch, who was representing himself, would trundle across the courtroom so he could see what was going on. It was all taking place to his back, as it were. That kind of practice invariably meant the jury was going to be aware of the shackles that are rattling, you know, as he crossed the room.
Well, it would have been the same if the tables had been flipped.
Yes.
So when you say the geography,
well,
I mean it. Perhaps there's a few seconds more of viewing, but once the shackles are viewed by the jurors on for even 10 minutes, Mr. Abbott, would it make a difference if it's viewed for 10 hours?
I suppose not, but the point is there's no dispute between the parties, I think, that the shackles were visible here, which is a key issue in the case. Most of the shackling and restraint cases, to get back to a point that you raised, Judge, it do involve unusually obstreperous criminal defendants, but a lot of times it's manifested in the courtroom. Mr. Van Satch, say what you will about his disciplinary record at the MCC, appeared in court at least 13 times prior to trial without any incident, and that includes 5 times between the date of his last disciplinary incident and the trial itself. And it seems to me that in this regard, the
He did have a pretty bad record, though, didn't he, of misbehavior?
Yeah.
Did you have to give the dog one bite?
I think you do. I don't think that in this case, certainly.
You have to give the dog one bite in the court. You have a right to misbehave once.
Not necessarily misbehave once, but the point is that the disciplinary record by itself, standing alone, would not be an adequate justification in this case when you balance it against his conduct and repeatedly before the judge himself.
Now, would you give us a sense of a temporal sense of this misconduct that the marshal relayed about the MCC? Because we're speaking about an institution which is a holding institution pretty adjacent to the courthouse. I mean, this isn't something, this is not a record of misbehavior several years past, as Mr. Ravitz said, a particular institution with some dated, you know, some whiskers on it, so to speak.
Right. I mean,
this report given to Judge Castillo was about events literally pre-trial, is that right?
The last one would have been about 2 months prior to the trial, but between that date and the date of trial, there were at least five additional appearances.
No, I'm not talking about how he conducts himself. And I don't question your representation at all about how he conducted himself in those status hearings prior to trial. I'm asking you, though, in that same time period or just preceding, or even during it, were there behaviors occurring during that same time period where he was making peaceful appearances before the judge?
The last one was December 8th, so the answer is yes.
So the judge has before him, does he not, someone who's appeared okay in before him, but at the same time just blocks away. He's having difficulties at the MCC.
I think that's an accurate statement.
So to Judge Bauer's point about what should a judge do when possessed of that relatively contemporary information about at a situs blocks away, he's conducting himself inappropriately.
The problem, Judge, and I see my time's up here.
No, I want you to answer.
The problem, I think, is that there's really nothing in this record to suggest that kind of a finding. There's no finding by Judge Castillo that he posed an escape risk. There's no specific finding, contrary to what the government asserts in its appeal, that he found that he was a security risk in terms of courtroom security. He simply recited some of the facts and circumstances relating to the MCC record without much elaboration, and then said he didn't want to, you know, he was going to accept them as objective evidence, and didn't want to hear, you know, didn't want to have mini trials on those issues. So I don't know that under Deck he made sufficient findings, even, you know, on this record, to support the shackling order, even if theoretically a defendant's prior conduct, while as a pretrial detainee in this case, might warrant, in some cases, it would not warrant it here.
Well, would you suggest the inquiry ought to be of the defendant himself by the judge and ask the judge to ask him to explain the pretrial detainee status problems? Would you want the judge to hear a recitation of his defense, if you will, of conduct in the holding institution just prior to trial?
If it were going to be the deciding factor in whether or not a pro se defender is going to be shackled, yeah, sure. I think it might be appropriate for the judge to certainly do engage a little more in a fact-finding process than occurred here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ravitz. Mr. Hotelling.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Chris Hotelling and I represent the United States in this matter. Obviously, as Mr. Ravitz has already gone through and during the course of his oral argument, the primary issue before the court today is the issue of whether or not the district court abused its discretion when it made the decision to review the defendant's disciplinary records at the MCC and make a decision that he was to be shackled during the course of the trial and the course of the trial in which he was representing himself pro se. Now, as the government and both... I'm sorry.
Representing himself pro se, does it...
Representing himself. Representing himself. I double meaning. I apologize.
Department of Redundancy with the department? Yeah.
Well taken, Your Honor.
Couldn't resist. Go ahead.
The standard that this court is required to consider, especially following the Supreme Court's recent decision in the Missouri versus Deck decision, is whether or not there is an adequate justification for the judge's decision to shackle the defendant. Now, the government readily agrees and will concede that the normal course and the normal procedure is for a defendant to appear at his trial without visible shackles. Now, there obviously, as the Supreme Court specifically identified in the Deck decision, that there are exceptions to that general rule. Physical security, risk of flight, things of that nature. And that is exactly what we have at issue in this case. As it was attached to the government's brief and as part of the unsealed record in before this court, there is a lengthy and serious disciplinary history of this defendant, as Your Honor indicated, Judge Flom, just blocks away at the MCC. And just to quibble minorly with Mr. Ravitz, the last disciplinary action or the last disciplinary report that is included in the sealed record is actually January 8, 2005. So about a month and a half prior to the trial taking place, there is an indication and there is a letter in the defendant's file in which the MCC warden indicates that he has had additional disciplinary conduct within the MCC. But I think that the conduct that Mr. Ravitz was referring to in December 8th is particularly troubling, and while I certainly can't get into Judge Castillo's mind, I'm certain was something that was of pressing on him when he made the decision to impose shackles on the defendant. And that's with respect to the defendant's conduct in the attorney room in the Dixon building.
Can you help me with a matter of chronology, I guess?
Yes.
At the time the district court undertook the Feretta inquiry, was the district court aware of the possibility of needing to use shackles? Had he been apprised of this disciplinary situation?
My understanding is this, Your Honor, and as Mr. Ravitz properly indicated, there were a variety of times during the chronology of the pretrial proceedings in which the defendant indicated that he wanted to represent himself. Now, interspersed in there was a competency evaluation that was performed on the defendant, and I think that the judge, as he indicated in many of his pretrial proceedings, wanted to review that competency evaluation before finally ruling. But to get specifically to your question, Your Honor, the records themselves, and I'm going to consult it. There is the December 8, 2004, there is a memorandum to the deputy to a United States deputy marshal regarding his conduct. I must assume that the district court judge had received this information because he specifically referenced it during the course of the pretrial proceedings. So my assumption is, and I don't know the procedure.
Let me perhaps help out and then tell you what my concern is. When the district court undertook the Feretta inquiry, did the district court point out to the defendant the fact that he might well be under restraints at the time of the he was representing himself, and his self-representation was going to make that all that more obvious to the jury, the fact that he was under restraints?
And I guess my answer to your question is, I know it's not generally appropriate to answer a question with a question, but nevertheless, when we're talking about the Feretta inquiry, there are a variety of stages, again, as I indicated prior, that in which the defendant indicated a desire to represent himself. Now, the judge finally made that conclusion that, all right, Mr. Van Sack, you can represent yourself shortly before the trial. As he indicated in the pretrial hearing, I want to review the competency report. I want to evaluate that competency report again, and then make my final ruling on the Feretta decision.
Though, engage in an inquiry with the defendant as to difficulties of as Feretta requires, self-representation and things of that nature. Didn't he have that colloquy?
He did have that colloquy but if your question is that during that colloquy, did he say to the defendant, it's very possible that you will be shackled?
That was my question.
I do not believe that during that Feretta colloquy, the district court indicated to the defendant that he was considering shackling during the course of the trial.
At the time the district court undertook that colloquy, was he aware of the marshal's memo and the possibility of having to place the defendant in shackles?
I must assume that the district court was aware of the MCC disciplinary files.
Thank you.
Taking then together, so moving as we are to the point in the trial when the judge indicates, and actually the day of the trial when the judge indicates to the defendant that he intends to impose an order whereby he will be shackled during the course of the trial. The district court did have these records. He had, and as I believe at least one of your honors has indicated during the earlier portion of the questioning of defense counsel, the judge has an obligation to preserve the integrity of the courtroom. He has an obligation to protect the parties in the courtroom. He has an obligation to protect the jurors who have come from all around this district in order to serve as jurors. And in light of the fact that he had at that time already ruled that the defendant will proceed pro se, he had an obligation to impose what he felt, what the district court felt to be reasonable sanctions or reasonable restrictions in order to ensure the
all
safety
we have to do is
courtroom.
Make sure that he didn't abuse his discretion. That's all the only problem we have.
And I believe the fact, given those disciplinary records, he did not.
I understand your position completely.
So I think, following up on Judge Ripple's question, at the time when he finally announces the determination that the restraints are to be had, does the defendant or standby counsel say anything at that point about how that would impair the representation?
And I'm sorry, Aaron, could you
when the judge announced on that it would proceed in a shackled state, was there any dialogue beyond when he announced that position?
No. Well, there was an objection. Let me say that there was an objection, but other than an objection being filed,
just
and registered,
just
that was
the,
it.
Just to the order, in effect, being entered, but not a dialogue about. Basically, a motion to reconsider.
There was no such motion.
Well, I don't mean a formal one.
And I understand, but even in the informal setting, there was no request prior to the jury being brought into the courtroom that the judge reevaluate that. Following the seating of the jury, the government did request that there be an additional statement of reasons for purposes of the record.
What type of clothing did the defendant wear during the trial?
He wore street clothing. I believe it was, as I remember, it was a pair of jeans and a white button collared shirt.
No indicia of prison garb of any sort.
That is correct. No indicia of prison garb at any point in time.
Thank you.
And then just, I know that there were some additional issues that were filed apart from the shackling issue. Just brief.
Weren't addressed.
Then, Your Honor, if there are no further questions, then I would respectfully request that the defendant's conviction and sentence be affirmed.
All right. Thank you, Sultan. Ms. Ravitch, your time has expired, but you may have a minute.
Let me just touch on one point that Mr. Hotelli made, which has to do with this notion of judicial discretion. I would respectfully suggest that what we're talking about here is not mere discretion, but an informed discretion, informed by the acknowledgement that shackles ordinarily should not be used. It's for that reason that this court can't simply defer to Judge Castillo's ruling, but must give it close scrutiny.
Don't you think an experienced trial judge would know that the normal course of operation as Ravitch is not to shackle someone?
I would hope so. But
you would think you would want a pronouncement from the trial judge that he's doing this, but he knows it's not the normal way to proceed in a criminal trial?
No, I think what I'm suggesting is the court has to make a better record. There has to be a better record for this court to evaluate on appeal than exists. Mr. Hotelling concedes he can't get into Judge Castillo's mind. That's one of the problems here, and it's a problem that DEC identifies, the need to make findings on the record, which simply may point out that you maybe accept the objective record with respect to Van Satcher's discipline at the MCC, but that isn't a statement of record why the need for shackles outweighs the general rule here. So I would suggest that the record here is lacking, and it is for that reason there is an abuse of discretion.
Our thanks to all counsel. Mr. Ravitch, I want to extend an additional thanks to the court for you accepting and ably representing Mr. Van Sack in this bill.
You're here.
Case is taken under advisement.